An apt headline for part of the gospel today might be, "Coming home again for the first time," with apologies to Marcus Borg. Jesus returns to Nazareth after what could be described as a wildly successful debut. He has earned a widespread reputation for wisdom and authority, proclaiming God's kingdom with provocative parables, exorcising demons, healing the sick, and he's just raised Jairus' daughter from the dead. You'd think he would be the epitome of a hometown hero, coming home again for the first time. Our origin stories. Rachel Held Evans says, these stories tell us who we are, where we come from, and what the world is like. These stories can dictate what we believe, the brands we buy, the holidays we celebrate, and the people we respect or despise. Each person's origin story shapes perspectives and behaviors. My own family narrative held on to the story of the old country. This origin story was dear to my father's first-generation heart. It was inaccessible to casual outsiders. Family origin stories were considered precious and not to be shared beyond a carefully selected circle. And I was told, behave well at all times. You all know how well I do that, but that's beside the point. And above all, hold on to the old principles. Success was deemed to be living a life where family values remained unchanged and unhealthy and healthy practices or beliefs were unchallenged. This was code for hold firm to your origin, remember who you are, do not compromise, and reject those who want to question any part of this. Does any of this sound familiar? Just a little? I wondered. So let's go back to the gospel again. Jesus returns to Nazareth with his disciples. I imagine they're eager to see where he grew up. So at first, things go well. There is astonishment and curiosity. How did he come to have this wisdom? Why didn't we see this when he was younger? However, curiosity soon sheds the veneer of civility, turning to outrage. Someone, perhaps a jealous neighbor of Mary or a childhood rival of Jesus, pulls out an old origin story and circulates it in the synagogue. Is this not the carpenter, the son of Mary, brother of James and Joseph and Judas and Simon? Are not his sisters among us? Let's look at that. To identify someone by his mother's name in Jesus' day was to question his legitimacy. This was calculated to shame him into silence, bring him into line with the shared origin story. In a social system where one's status was fixed at birth, it was not considered possible for someone like Jesus, a mere carpenter of questionable parentage, to amount to anything. The suspicion and resentment of the villagers diminished Jesus' ability to work with and on their behalf. Mark writes with grim finality, he could do no deed of power there. The unpredictable and unfamiliar was not welcome. The villagers could not imagine a roomier or newer story, and thus missed God in their midst. I wonder how we might sometimes misuse our own and others' origin stories. How might those deeply held perspectives limit God's deeds of power? Where might misuse sneak in and limit our participation in the unfolding narrative of the Holy Spirit around us? So back to Held Evans. She continues, spiritual maturation requires untangling these origin stories, sorting fact from fiction, or more precisely, truth from untruth, and embracing those narratives and values which move us towards wholeness while rejecting or reinterpreting those who do harm. My own origin story, with its tales of courage, the honoring of extended family, and the history of religious activism, contained aspects which distanced me from opportunity and wholeness. It is a challenge to untangle the pieces of origin story, which have dictated who my friends ought to be and which ethnic groups I should distrust and people I must avoid. I've had to relinquish those parts of my origin narrative that weakened, diminished, and imprisoned me. And not always being a person of patience, it certainly has required patience and humility. And origin stories have been a focus this past week. Last Sunday, we celebrated Canada Day. And then 3 days later, for our neighbors to the south, it was Independence Day. And this is the final day of celebration of Pride Week. So I wonder, what could it look like beneath the hype and rhetoric to honor the origin story of our countries, our very checkered history of inclusion, and our need for healthy reconciliation? How might we honor both our brokenness and our blessedness in the 21st century? I want to leave those questions with you. And I want to move to looking at our village. This week has been hard. A member of our extended community has died. Someone whom you may have met. She was young, well known in the recovery community, and was a member of the recovery yoga group that meets here every Tuesday evening. She had been 8 years clean and sober. She had supportive family, a young son, and was doing apparently well. Last Saturday, she died of an overdose. The opioid crisis has taken the lives of people we have known and cared for. She is, however, for me, the name and face of the 3.6 overdose deaths per day in this province. I emphasize, per day. So before one goes down the road of asking why, what led her to do this, let's look at the origin stories which shape our beliefs and attitudes towards substance use. These days, overdose deaths occur most often when the individual is not only housed, but uses alone. What is the narrative that causes people, either through focused substance use, experimentation, or recreation, to use alone? How do origin stories sustain their evil influence on the vulnerable? How is it that there remains such a powerful stigma around substance use? How are we able to acknowledge the brokenness in ourselves and our communities? What origin stories become destructive when someone is going to use? Where is grace? Where truly is the evil? Those same questions apply when I think of the recent death of a woman whose life ebbed away around 2 weeks ago within feet of this cathedral. I first knew about it as a headline or a small piece in the newspaper. And then, enraged and tearful, someone came to tell me about her. She was in her 60s. and alone. She had virtually nothing to live on and had been fighting, and I note with help, expert help actually, through the bureaucracy for over 2 years to access funding through the Persons with Disability funding, for which she was a very deserving candidate. The excuse? Backlog. I don't know the manner of her death, but I do know that the agency worker who had supported and worked closely with her was called to identify her body, which was lying naked under a tarp in Pioneer Square. It was devastating for that person, and even more so when the response from an employee of PWD, of the PWD office, was informed of the death. They said, oh good, one less to deal with. The community workers who fought for her rightful access to funds and support were the ones who were her Good Samaritans. They were ambushed repeatedly in their attempts to get her to an inn of safety. So I ask again, where is grace? Where truly is the evil? What origin story propelled her to her death? And they took offense at him. He could do no deed of power there, except he laid his hands on a few sick people and cured them. He was amazed at their unbelief. The disconcerting truth about the gospel is that we, the church, can be the modern-day equivalent of the ancient townspeople of Nazareth. We can be caught in the myth that we know Jesus best. We can be the ones jaded by religious overfamiliarity. We can be the ones who take offense when he comes in faces we recognize and resent. The scandal of the incarnation is precisely that. God is the hometown boy made good. He is the lowly carpenter. He is the one whose birth is questioned. He is the brother of, the son of, the rebellious teenager who experimented. We might be scandalized. Our origin stories enrich us as individuals and as faith communities, yet unexamined narratives can leave us standing with the Nazarene townspeople. Where is grace? Where truly is grace?